This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, when the settlers came to Cape Breton from Scotland, did they bring with them anything mysterious and mischievous? Little people with an affinity for the braiding of horses' tails and playing tricks on people. You'll hear about that research on a book about fairies in Cape Breton. And later, a Cape Bretoner helps out in the world's longest treasure hunt. A rare coin expert talks about his visits to the set of the TV show The Curse of Oak Island. These stories coming up on Coast 89.7. On The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks to retired land and sea TV show producer Mary Munson about research she's doing for a book about fairies in Cape Breton. Mary's hoping listeners will contact her if they wish to share stories about the little people.
So, Mary, there are many different cultures, and they have different versions of what fairies are. And, of course, here in Cape Breton, the Highland Scots have a strong fairy belief. Let's just start off with, and many other cultures, which we're going to get into. Why don't we just start off with where your interest in fairies or pixies or whatever they go by, the little people. Where did your interest in all this come from?
Well, for many years I worked at CBC. In the last few years of my career at CBC, I worked on a show called Land and Sea. Two versions of that show, you know, one out of Newfoundland and one out of Halifax. And my boss many years ago came to me and said, do you know anything about fairies in Cape Breton? Do you want to look into that? And I did a little bit. And, you know, that is a hard, talking about fairies on the phone is a very hard thing to do, because nobody really wants to talk to somebody they don't know very well about these beliefs, in case some people think they're crazy. So, in fact, I just went back to the boss and said, I don't think that's going to work. So then, you know, a few years later, fast forward, I marry a Cape Bretoner and we move here. And I start just talking about it casually among people. And, so, you know, one woman said to me, oh, yeah, the little people. Yeah, for sure. So I started making some more calls. And the first call, of course, was, as you might imagine, to Jim St. Clair and others like that. And sure enough, I had enough to put a show together. But and it was very favorably received. But there was a lot I left on the floor. You know, some stories are too long. Some are hard to tell in television, good for radio, not great for TV. So I thought, oh, maybe there is a book here. And so I've been working on it steadily for about 3 years now, putting this book together. And I've had, you know, the best part of the job, Paul, is interviewing people and getting to know them. So that's what I've been doing for the last while. And it's been a wonderful treat. And I've got to meet many different Cape Bretoners.
Some of the my limited knowledge of the little people thing is sometimes they may be able to influence things to happen or to not happen. So do you think there was some kind of karma involved in your own situation and why you ended up here and now you're trying to document their lives in a, you know, a somewhat reverential fashion?
I think so. You know, I believe in things that are perhaps preordained or kismet or karma, all of those things, where one thing leads you to another. And I think, in fact, that did happen. I didn't know many people when I moved to Cape Breton, except my husband's immediate family. And as I've started to branch out, I've got to meet many, many people who shared many different beliefs. And I think there is some path that led me this way, for sure.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the groups of peoples from Cape Breton. And let's start off with the Scots. And for the most part, they're the Highland Scots. And there's some belief or knowledge, theory, whatever you call it, that the fairies came along with them for the ride. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about the Highland Scots and the fairies and what these people believe?
Yeah, well, it would be the what we call the Gaels, right, who are from the Hebridean Islands and from the Highlands of Cape of Scotland, who came here. And one thing that really interested me about this Gael belief, because I think of Scots as hard-working, strict, not much fun kind of people, but in fact they did have this belief. And if you go back in time, you'll see that one of the, back to the 1700s, but the Reverend Robert Kirk said that believing in God and believing in fairies were actually part of believing in God. You weren't Christian if you didn't believe in fairies. So it was, it's actually very profound that the Scots believe, that the Scots brought with them. Now, I don't have contemporary stories, but I do, and I have met several people who believe in the fairies and are still waiting to see them, but, you know, who think that they have affected the music of Inverness County, people whose stories have been passed down in family members. I mean, one of the best stories and one of the most common stories you'll find, and it actually crosses all our cultures, is the braiding of the horses' tails and manes. And I have stories from all, from the Mi'kmaq, from the Gaels, and from the French. In French, the word for fairies is lutin, L-U-T-I-N-S. And those stories came from northern France, from Brittany and Normandy. And those stories came with them, and then they seem to have crossed over into all the cultures. There's fascinating stories from all over the island, and even one from the 1990s. It's not that long ago.
For a number of years, I was a storyteller in the cabin at Celtic Colors at Coxeth Mountain, and I would get some, you know, other way more knowledgeable storytellers to come. I was more the wrangler. I would get people to come and then introduce them. But Hector McNeil, who's a well-known Gaelic speaker and teacher, he would often tell stories about the fairies. And no doubt, the one about the fairies showing up and braiding horses' tails, and he had countless kind of versions of this story. And one, people always were fascinated that when he would get to the end of the story, and what had happened was like a horse's tail, and you can imagine trying to braid a horse's tail, right?
Yes,
it gets done. And two, that this seemed to be a common thing from different people would say that this has happened. What do you think of that, this whole horse tail thing?
Well, it's hard to figure out. In fact, I think Shakespeare talks about it too, going back that far. But you know, the tails, when we tape the show, and the photograph will be in the book, of a tail that has been so intricately braided together that it was almost, it's almost impossible in some cases to untangle it. It's just not possible, but not even a hairdresser, I think, could do it. And you know, who was a great believer in the horses and their braids and their lives was Father John Angus Rankin. He certainly believed in fairies.
So
it is part of all these cultures.
What about the Irish?
Well, here's what been in my little search here. Been interesting. I haven't been able to find much Irish or any. I've seen small mentions of some sightings, but in fact, what I'm understanding now is that the Irish didn't hold on to their culture as completely as the Gaels did, that somehow it got dissipated and diluted by modern times. So although, of course, there was lots of movement in older times, in the old days, between Ireland and Scotland, so there is some crossover, but there is not a distinct Irish, or let me say I'm looking for that.
Right.
If anybody has some stories from Irish culture, I'd be delighted to hear them.
Yeah, because in, you know, Ireland itself, you go around, we were fortunate to be there a few years ago, and we did drove, and I got to cycle some of the Ringakerry, which was great, but and you could stop at places, and it'd be like, there's a fairy hole there, and there's a guy, like, sitting there, you know, reading a book, charging you, like, you know, 50 cents or something to go in, and then when you go up and see this thing, it's hugely elaborate thing with holes cut through it and everything, and they were saying, this is a fairy hole. So let's talk a little bit about those kind of things.
It's true. I mean, we can go here in Cape Breton to the fairy hole, right? I mean, you know, the Mi'kmaq word for fairies is Wiglaatamooch. And what is very interesting to me is that this belief is very alive within Mi'kmaq communities. And as Clifford Paul told me from Member 2, when people tell you a story, and this did in fact happen to me, It's like you're an eyewitness. You did see them. You can describe them. You can describe what they were wearing and all that. I met one man who played with them in Member 2 when he was a young boy. So it's pretty stunning to me, these stories that are contemporary stories and are part of our culture.
So there's another notion that the fairies... they're more in the country or with people like the Mi'kmaq who, you know, for centuries lived off the land and or farmers and that. And you're not going to run into a fairy downtown Charlotte Street pre-pandemic, you know, coming out of the old triangle or something.
No, they're very much part of the rural landscape. And I know people who live both here and, you know, have big ties in Inverness County. And they have a sense, they have a, that they are closer in the country to the fairies. One of the women I talked to, you know, her father used to put out, he was a farmer, he used to put out milk and such for the fairies to drink. And that was might be a way to appease them because not all fairies can be nice, right? We have a Tinkerbell idea that all fairies do good things and save us all. But in fact, they can mess up your life in some way. But in the landscape, in the country, in nature, in the barns, around the barns, maybe not living in the barns, but they'll go into barns, but they are definitely a part of nature.
So those that are, well, we basically in tune with nature could be more in tune with maybe perhaps having a visitation from one or a group of these, less if you have less noise and clutter in your life?
That's it. One of the women I talked to, it was her grandfather, who was from Iona, who said, you know, we have so much chaos in our life. We're so busy. We don't stop to think. We go from project to project, to, you know, to phone, to email, to TV, and we just never quieten ourselves enough to be in tune with nature. And, of course, being in tune with nature is a good thing no matter what, right? It brings you back to your sense of self. So if you get some visit, or I think that would be a fantastic bonus.
Now, as you said, some of the stories of fairies are maybe somewhat more mischievous, or they could potentially cause a problem in one's life, but there are ways to ward them off as well. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, iron is one of the ways that you can ward them off. There are stories from the old days about if you hammered a nail into a fairy hole before you went in to visit, you would be allowed to leave, because there are stories that fairies can take you off into their realm, and you might think you've been gone a day, and when you come out, a year has passed, and the world has changed dramatically. So that's one way. Interestingly, I have a doctor here. My doctor, she was brought up with putting rocks in her pockets before she went out to play, to keep the fairies away from taking her off to their realm. You know, a fairy can go into a barn and move implements around or hang them in different places and be searching for them. And that would be blamed on the fairies.
It's Yeah, it's kind of remarkable, really, that so many people, have accounts of these.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, you mentioned Hector, and Hector McNeil has a story from the 1930s at his grandfather's farm. And it's been written down in another publication as well. It will be in my book, but about the peddler coming to his grandfather's farm, and the braids on the horse were braided. And his grandfather, who was a no-nonsense kind of guy, brought up children on his own, and he just said, I have to believe it's the fairies. Nobody could do this. Nobody.
Another thing about fairies is they... there's some belief that they're shapeshifters. They can turn into something
yes.
else.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've heard this. There's a woman who believes there's a. It looks like just a peak in a cliff, and in fact, she believes that in that cliff is a deer in the shape, in the form of a fairy. And they can take on different shapes in animals as well. So yeah, they are shapeshifters for sure. So you never quite know who you might be meeting.
So when we think of elves, are fairies elves?
Yeah, for sure.
And from what I understand, Iceland is like, in around Reykjavik, they actually have an elf school.
Tell us
about that.
But it's a place where you can go and visit and learn how elves live. I mean, the thing about Icelandic people is that there are 50% of the population, no more than 50, believe in the possibility of the little people or in the little people themselves. It's very alive. I mean, and even in Ireland, you know, they've changed road directions or, you know, putting in ramps, they've changed directions because they said the fairies would be unhappy with a road going through.
They've literally bypassed sections of the countryside to avoid disturbing the fairy hole where they live.
Right, that's it. Or even fairy tree.
Hmm.
So to protect a fairy tree, they've put roads around a tree instead of tearing down the tree.
So how can a human then, how does a human know that something is a fairy hole? What's the distinguishing characteristics?
I don't think there's anything from the outside, but if you went up to one, you might hear some music, right? That's fairies are known for playing music in their dens, and if you hear music, it might very well be some fairies in there.
So this will get carried down over generations at this particular...
Yeah, for sure.
And you may not have to hear the music all the time, but at one point somebody did. Is that the kind of idea?
Yes, that's it.
And
that's
it's been
it.
Marked out as that's what it is. There is some other version of that. You could cut some sods and...
Yes.
How's that work?
Well, and I've now read several stories about this, that if you were building a house, I'm going back to the settler days, and you put down marks where your four corners of your house would be, and if those marks were moved in the morning when you got up, then you knew that the fairies were unhappy with where you were putting your house, because that was a fairy path.
Wow.
So you'd have to move it.
To
appease them.
And if it remained the same, then it would be okay to go ahead with your plans.
Yeah, that's it.
Right.
It's so great.
It is. And so, like you said, you've been on this for 3 years, and you're looking for more stories.
Yes, I'm always looking for more stories, and I'd actually like to broaden it out a bit to include some of the other peoples that have come to settle Cape Breton. You know, I'm talking about the Ukrainian community and the Syrian and Lebanese community, the Jewish community. I'm the Black community, you know, that came from the States and from the Caribbean. I'd love to hear stories from their cultures as well.
Well, one would definitely think that, you know, just by going by how many different cultures and ethnic groups have these stories that these other cultures would as well, and you know, older people would have passed some stories down, right?
Well, exactly, and that's what I'm hoping to find.
Yeah, right. So how can people reach you?
Well, I'd love to give you my email. It's
sure.
Mary Munson, so all one word. Munson is spelled M-U-N-S-O-N. So MaryMunson11 at gmail.com.
MaryMunson11 at gmail.com.
Yeah.
So that's great, because if people are... people are interested in this or have something they can add.
Oh, that would be terrific. I'd love to hear from people.
Yeah, so this is kind of a long-term project.
Yeah, I hope to finish it within the year.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to be able to wrap it up. I was listening to your interview with Dan McIver, and I thought he said something really interesting about this pandemic time. It's a great time to be writing, it's a great creative time to be using, to be journeying through this time, and I think it's actually done a great job for me.
Yeah, that's good, because I think some people might have been found it hard to be motivated, creative people or people working on things, whereas some people I know always say that, but others are really trying to take advantage of it and getting things done, you know, that otherwise maybe they wouldn't have.
That's it. It's been a real kick for me.
Yeah.
It's helped me get through this, no doubt.
Well, that's all terrific. So do you have one last short little fairy story you want to leave our listeners with?
Oh my goodness, a short one. Just give me a second here.
Okay.
Well, I have a great story.
Here we go. Just once again, this is Mary Munson. She's going to wrap up our interview about fairies and the little people in Cape Breton, hoping to get more stories from listeners to go in her book. And she's just going to finish off here with a story of her own.
Well,
or that she knows.
That I know, yeah. There's a great story of a friend of mine who... a new friend of mine who was driving on the Escasoni Highway one day and, in fact, had to stop, dead stop, in front of her because there were four fairies, or it's a hard word for me to say in Mi'kmaq, but Wiglatamooch, in front of her. And lo and behold, she could draw them for me, and it was pretty extraordinary. And she held up traffic. She was on a hill, so nobody could pass her. And they came up, someone came up to her and said, are you okay? And she said, yeah, but look, I'm just seeing these friends. I have new friends. And she said they were waving at her, and she was throwing kisses at them and all like that. And it's a story that just has stayed with me and will stay with me for the rest of my life.
That's great. Thanks, Mary.
Okay. Thank you.
Oak Island is a privately owned island in Lunenburg County on the south shore of Nova Scotia. It's believed by some that the island is home to a buried treasure worth a fortune, and for more than 200 years, adventurers have been trying to find it. Sandy Campbell of Proof Positive Coins Limited in Bedeck is an expert in rare coins and artifacts, and he was invited there to the set of a reality TV show to offer his opinion on some of the things they uncovered there. Here's Sandy on his experience on the Curse of Oak Island, and he begins talking about how his interest in coins started.
You know, as a kid... you know, when I was probably 10, 11, 12 years old, I developed a bit of an interest in coins in general. And we had a local grocery business in Bedeck, Campbell's Cash Market. And I worked there during the summer. So the first real boom or rush in gold and silver was in the early 70s. And I was literally picking silver coins out of circulation and shipping them off and getting back about, you know, $1.40 on the dollar, you know, 40% return. So that was pretty big money for a 12-year-old kid at the time. And then it just kind of went from there. You know, I graduated high school in 78, was going to university in Halifax that following fall. And because of the way the coin market had evolved, I decided not to go, went back home for a year. Then I went into, the following year, I went to pre-vet medicine in Truro, agricultural college, and the market completely boomed. And I literally was driving back and forth on the weekends, doing more coin business than schoolwork. And, you know, after a year, I realized that my path was probably set, and it wasn't going to be a DVM. It was going to be, you know, chasing rare coins around. So that's sort of it in a nutshell, I guess.
And up to that point, what was your rarest find or most valuable find?
At that point in my career, I probably had, you know, coins worth several $100. That would have been it, $300 or $400. Nothing major, just, you know, I bought and sold a lot of silver coins and would buy the odd gold coin and hoard them away and, you know, just, you know, really kind of reinvested my profit into collectible coins. And, you know, 4 or 5 years later, it turned into, yeah, I guess it was probably 82 or 83 when we went full hog into the industry and started doing the national circuit. So from about, you know, 78, 79 to 82, 83, I kind of kicked around locally. Like I said, just reinvesting profits into, you know, holdings. And then, you know, in the early 80s, I decided it was going to be my career.
And fast forward a bit, you get a call from a very popular reality TV show based in Nova Scotia, The Curse of Oak Island. And that's where the world's longest treasure hunt is taking place, going back to the late 1700s. And you were there a few times to offer your opinion on some of their findings for the brothers, Rick and Marty Lagina. And what was that experience like for you?
Well, I've been around a long time. I'm 60 years old, so, you know, we get contacted to do a lot of, you know, sort of crazy things in the industry. You know, we've done things for Parks Canada, for, you know, the Bank of Canada, the Royal Canadian Mint. And we're fairly well known in the industry, you know, basically worldwide in the industry, we're fairly well known. So we get weird calls all the time. So, you know, the initial call was a little bit funny. It was an email and then a phone call. And, you know, there was, you know, obviously demands attached to this. So, again, at a point in my life where, you know, we kind of want easy instead of things that are demanding. But I just had a sense that this might be something that we should pursue, because I had no idea why we were being contacted. This came through, you know, the back door kind of thing. And, you know, I had no idea it was the Curse of Oak Island. But I decided, because of what they were demanding, it must have been something that, you know, was a worthwhile endeavor. So we followed up on it. And, you know, once we signed an NDA, then, you know, they basically told us, you know, what was involved. And, you know, from that point on, it became a bit of a venture. Obviously, we visited the island probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 times, I guess.
For one of those visits, you evaluated an object. It kind of looked like a knob or a handle for a chest, and they wanted to know if it was made of gold or brass. And can you talk about that visit, and what do you think it was?
They were quite excited about that find, and rightfully so. I mean, it was a fairly, you know, intricate, you know, brass handle off probably some kind of a high-end chest. And you could just tell by the way that the item was made, you know, it was a very thinly made doorknob, which is very unusual for, you know, it would be on something more decorative. And it was quite ornate, although it didn't, you couldn't really see that in the show, I don't think, that, you know, the intricate detail of the doorknob. So it was a very, you know, it was a very high-end knob that came off, you know, a fairly expensive chest, whether it was a treasure chest or, you know, simply a chest of drawers belonging to somebody with a little bit of money, who really knows. But the color threw everybody, you know, on the island off. To me, it was quite obvious. It was brass. It wasn't gold, although it, you know, would fool almost everybody as being gold. You know, depending on the composition, you know, you can get brass, you know, that does look like gold, depending on how much zinc is in the alloy.
How old do you think that item was, or how old do you think that item is, and where did it come from?
I'm guessing it was English, sometime in the 1700s, late 1700s to 1850. It's pretty hard to be definitive. You just have to go, you really go by the way that the piece is made and comparables, and that's all you can really go on. You know, when I saw it on the show, that was the first and only time I saw that item. You know, they sprung it on me on the show, and, you know, so you really, you go on what your knowledge is of that particular item. That's our best guess, and it's probably in that period, you know, late 1700s to mid-1850s.
And recently, you talked to local journalist Rose Mary Godin about your visit to Oak Island, and you talked about a Chinese coin, also with a very interesting design. What information were you able to share on that discovery?
Well, the Chinese coin, again, it's something that really excited, you know, the crew and the cast on the island. And rightfully so. It was a cool item. You know, Chinese cash coins were produced for more than 2,000 years. This particular coin, likely, you know, and I couldn't totally identify it because I'd need to do a lot of research, because you'd have to identify, you know, the characters, which were very faint on the coin. But the method of production, the narrow rims, it was probably something 300 BC, 250 BC to, you know, probably 600 AD. You know, it would be hard to really definitively nail it, because there was so much of parts of the coin that were, you know, were worn out, you know, being buried in the ground for who knows how long. But if I had to take a real educated guess, I'm thinking, you know, 600 to 900 AD, which would put it in, I think, the Tang Dynasty. But it could be earlier than that, too. And likely, you know, came on the island as, you know, as a keepsake. I don't think it's part of any treasure. You know, the value of a Chinese cash coin is pretty minimal in terms of spending power. You know, nobody's going to, you know, bury a treasure chest full of Chinese cash coins. You wouldn't have a whole lot of money if you filled up a, you know, a cubic yard chest with Chinese cash coins.
Okay, so that would be like someone burying a chest full of pennies or nickels now?
So a Chinese cash coin, in terms of relative value, 1,000 cash coins is equal to one tael. And the tael would be about 37 grams of silver, you know, and the tael has changed in terms of weighting value. So let's just say, for instance, you know, figure an ounce of silver. So an ounce of silver today is 35 bucks. You're talking 1,000 pieces would be worth $35 in terms of spending power. So much less than a penny. However, you know, 2,000 years ago, a Chinese cash coin would, you know, probably buy you, you know, a day's worth of food.
And about that coin, it had a square hole in it. Why do you think it was designed that way?
Well, it's just the way the coins are made. Chinese cash coins in that period were cast, meaning, you know, that melt, you know, produce bronze, and then they would pour it into what they call a cast couple die. Like, so you know, they'd carve out, you know, they'd carve out what you'd call a tree of coins, okay? So you might have 15 carvings on either clay or stone on one side, and then you'd couple it with the other side of the coin, okay? So you'd have two halves, and you might have 15 pieces in there, all attached, you know, with a vein, which would give you a tree effect when it was, you know, when the thing was poured and then cooled down. So the reason for the square hole is that after these were cast, okay, and they would cool down, you'd have rough edges on each piece, okay? So they'd cut, you know, they'd cut the vein, so you'd have the coin, but they would remain in place, and they could file the edges without them turning if it was a square edge, a square hole. So they could literally file off and make the coin, you know, more presentable and round. Whereas if it was round, you know, you'd be chasing it around in circles, literally. So that was the reasoning for the square hole. Now, later on, they made Chinese cash coins with round holes as well. So you'd have square and round holes as, you know, later on. And these coins were produced up until 1912 in the empire. So anything produced from, say, 1750 to 1912, a lot of that stuff would have a round hole. And some of it was struck later on in the 1800s. Some of it, you know, would have been poured technology.
The purpose of that square hole, it had a practical purpose. And did it make it easier to carry the coins by inserting a string and attaching them if you didn't have a pocket available?
Well, you know what? Historically, you know, these things got carried around, you know, on a string, okay? I think more by accident. It wasn't the intent when these, you know, before they had cash coins, they had, you know, knife money, and they had all kinds of different objects that represented, you know, what we call modern-day money. But the hole in general served a great purpose because, you know, for instance, you could put 100 pieces on a, you know, on a string, and you'd have 1/10 of a tail. So it would represent, you know, a fairly substantial value at that time, and it made it easier to carry them around for sure. But that was more by accident than anything else.
You mentioned you signed an NDA, or a non-disclosure agreement, so no spoilers, of course, but from your visits there and seeing how their work is unfolding and the coins and artifacts discovered there, are they on to something? What kind of activity took place there over the centuries? And a lot of fans are probably on the edge of their seats waiting for the big discovery there at Oak Island.
Yeah, I mean, I think the show has portrayed a pretty good picture of probably what's happened there. I don't have any doubt there was treasure in that island, okay? Whether it's still there remains to be seen. I mean, I wouldn't discount the treasure not still being there. But, you know, there's parts of the story that haven't been told yet that, you know, I'm a little bit privy to, I guess, but I think, you know, I think it's a real cool story. It's been a great journey for that whole crew. I mean, we've just been a little part of it, not really much, you know, from our end, we're not a significant part of it. We're just telling, you know, a little bit of history on a few of the things that have been found there. But in general, I think, you know, there's more to the story to come. And you know, all I can say is I think, you know, there was a treasure there. And, you know, possibly it's still there. Who put it there? You know, nobody really knows that. But, there was substantial evidence, you know, a few hundred years ago that it existed there, and I think they're gonna get to the bottom of this mystery before it's all done.
So a few years ago, local writer Richard Lorway published an article, and I'll just read a bit of it here, where he says, stories of the Myra River are full of pirate legends that go back hundreds of years to the time before the fortress of Louisbourg. And he writes, historic records indicate that Bartholomew Roberts, also known as Black Bart, the most successful captain of the golden age of piracy from 1650 to 1730, once used the Myra as an operating base. And looking at the map, Sandy, Nova Scotia and Cape Breton would make sense geography-wise for a convenient stop on their way to the Americas from Western Europe. And would you be surprised to learn about significant findings here in Cape Breton as something of what's expected in Oak Island, anything along those lines?
Yeah, we've had some things that have shown up in homes in Atlantic Canada that were put there 200 years ago. You know, so that's a treasure, okay? You know, if you want to relate it to pirates, yeah, the place was full of pirates, the major mode of transport from one world to the other. You know, we had the New World and the Old World, and you know, there probably were a lot of things that happened that, you know, even history's not going to find out about. But yeah, Cape Breton, you know, we're one of the, you know, first stopping points in North America if you're coming anywhere from the Old World. So yeah, I think there was a heavy presence of pirates in, you know, on our island. There's been no folklore as to stuff buried anywhere here, but you know, there's been, you know, little treasures that have showed up again, you know, hidden in houses that are a few hundred years old. But in terms of buried treasures, I'm not really aware of any.
And you enjoyed being on the show where you can share your expertise in something you're passionate about, and maybe your involvement will help them eventually find what they're looking for, if anything is there or not.
Well, you know what? I'm passionate about anything that makes our, you know, our home better. And what I mean by that is Nova Scotia. So I was, a very willing participant to help any way we could to make it, you know, make the story, you know, go forward and you know, promote our area. I think everybody in the province should really, you know, at some point take a run down there and see what these folks are doing, because it, you know, they've got a little museum there and they've got, you know, they do some tours on the island. And, you know, this show's syndicated in 82 countries and it's totally unscripted. It's reality TV, but it's unscripted. Nobody put anything in front of me and said, this is what we want you to say. They're looking for your honest to goodness, you know, educated opinion. And from that, they've built, you know, I guess they're in their eighth season. You know, they built something quite amazing. And even Rick, I've talked to Rick about it. You know, he's just shocked that it ever went this far. They expected a 2-year, you know, series and they'd be out of there. But, you know, they're already planning next year, so.
What are the rules for treasure hunters in discovering artifacts and coins and relics and things like that? When you find something, who does it belong to?
Depends on where it's found. I mean, if you know, if you have a piece of property, you dig down, you know, in that property and, you know, find $1 million worth of gold, well, guess what? You own it. If it's treasure lost at sea, there's all kinds of legal issues. A lot of treasures that have gone down in ships belong to insurance companies, and they belong to the province. So, you know, any treasures that have been found, like the, you know, the Feversham and the Etosha, you know, there's a lot that goes into putting that stuff in the market, because quite frankly, the province takes, you know, the lion's share, and they'll allow you to keep some of it, but, you know, they will take it, put whatever they want in museums and, you know, take the proceeds for anything you want to sell and give you back, you know, a percentage. And that's changed over the years. Like, it used to be almost prohibitive. When Alex Storm found the Chameau, it was at that time, the province just basically took it all. You know, they left him with a little bit. And since then, you know, things have backed up a bit, and the province is a little more lax with a couple of the other discoveries. So,
and not to get off topic here, but a few years ago the penny became obsolete; it went out of circulation. What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? There's really two schools of thought when you pull a coin out of circulation. You know, the long and short, the penny, it's part of what I do, okay? You know, we buy and sell rare coins and paper money, and you hate to see anything pulled from circulation. But it costs 1.7 cents for the government to produce a penny. So it didn't make economic sense to continue producing a penny, okay? At the same time, historically, it's proven that when you pull a denomination out, it creates inflation. So, you know, you get rounding at the bottom end, but it does create a tiny bit of inflation in your economy. So, I mean, would I prefer to keep the penny? You know, all things equal, yes, but if the government's paying 1.7 cents to produce it, you know, the short answer is no. Get rid of the penny. And, you know, I mean, there's better places for the government to spend money than subsidizing a coin to the tune of, you know, almost its full value. So,
you know, of course, it seems people don't have a change jingling in their pockets anymore as much as they used to. But have you ever heard from someone who pulls out a handful of quarters and nickels and dimes and they notice something unusual about one of the coins? And how likely is it to find a rare, valuable coin like this now? And is it worth looking into if you see something along the way?
You know, unfortunately, we're sort of past that time where you could, you know, go in your pocket or in a till and pull out something of value. You know, you need, you know, what makes coins valuable, number one is rarity, obviously, then you have condition, and then metal content. Well, or then an oddity, okay, like a minting error, okay? Today, everything is made out of, you know, bonded. It's not even made out of nickel anymore. You got alloys that, you know, really don't have much value, for starters. You know, even if you go back, the last time we had anything significant you could pull out of circulation would be 1973. So the 1973 quarter, there were two varieties that got issued. You know, one by mistake was called a large bus quarter for the 1973 Mountie issue. And that coin today is worth like $100. And you could pull them out of circulation. If you go back just a few years before that, Canada, when we went from silver to nickel coinage, in 1968, we commissioned the U.S. Mint to look at a few different minting techniques on nickel and clad copper nickel coins. So one of the coins that actually got sampled was a nickel dime in 1969, and it has what they call a larger reverse. They call it a large date reverse. And these coins are struck in Philadelphia, and a handful of them got shipped to Ottawa for approval. And in the end, they didn't go with that design. They actually went with a smaller ship. The large design was from the 1968 dime, okay? So we were in a lot of transition. We went from 800 pure silver in 66, and then halfway through 67, we went to 500 pure, 500 fine, and then halfway through 68, we went to nickel. So at the end of 68, they were looking at other ways, and that's why they brought in the Philadelphia Mint, because they had converted in 1965 to a non-silver coinage. So anyway, these coins were stuck in Philadelphia, shipped back to the Mint for their per usual, and the design was sort of rejected, and they went to a new, smaller ship. However, these coins did not get destroyed, and, you know, somewhere between 20 and 50 coins probably exist. No one really knows. There's probably less than 20 known. But they literally were probably tossed into a bag of coins and just shipped out to a bank. And oddly enough, most of them have showed up in the Maritimes over the years. And an average one of those sells for $10,000 or $12,000. And a really nice one sells for as high as $50,000. So that's a long answer to your question. That coin, as recently as a year ago, we bought one from somebody that pulled one out of change. So that coin still circulates in the Maritimes. And, you know, that would be the only thing that you would possibly find in your regular change, because a dime, you know, from 69 is going to fit in with a dime from 2021.
And just to wrap up here, Sandy, I wanted to ask you, on your visits to the set of The Curse of Oak Island, you said something interesting in one of the shows. You said, the real treasure is in the journey. And what do you mean by that?
Well, you know what? I mean, life is a bit short, okay? And I have two kids, and one of my kids is a professional golfer. He's played literally all over the world, and he's had some success. He's won over in China, And I've always told them, you know, what you're doing is no different than what Tiger Woods did. You know, it's really the journey. Your journey is no different than Tiger Woods or anybody else in that industry. And, you know, that is the reward. It's the journey. It's not, you know, the treasure is not the big, you know, $100 million earnings on the PGA Tour. It's the fact that you got to travel the world, you met all kinds of people, you get to see all kinds of really cool places, and you get respect from people you don't even know. And that's no different with what the Lagina brothers did and their partner, Mr. Tester. I mean, you know, the journey there, when they look back, is going to be the treasure. You know, if they find a treasure chest worth $10 million, it's, you know, Marty's worth a couple hundred million dollars. It's not going to change their lives at all, okay? It'd make a great story for us, but the treasure is going to be the journey. And I don't care what you're doing, if you're looking for a treasure chest or if you're just living your life. You know, that's basically what I've told both my kids.
That's all for Dialogue this week on The Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of The Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.